Our next speakers are Chris van der Merwe and Owen King from Milliman. Chris is a consultant in the Milliman non-life practice in Johannesburg. Prior to joining Milliman, he spent 5 years working at Telesure in the corporate actuarial team. He supports HAF deliverables for Milliman's non-life HAF clients and other engagements, covering new product and pricing reviews, IFRS and SAM valuations, also scenario and projection reviews, and reinsurance optimization assessments. Owen is a principal consulting actuary at Milliman's Dublin office. He is a fellow with the Ireland Society of Actuaries. His expertise stretch across Solvency II, IFRS reporting, product development, enterprise risk management, mergers and acquisitions, internal model development, and capital management. He serves as a HAF for several clients, as well as a reviewing actuary. Welcome to Chris in person and Owen, who is joining us online.
Okay, thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for Asa and Stick, of course, for organizing the event. Really do appreciate it. All right, so topic today, talking about recovery and resolution planning. So, I mean, we're all familiar with the phrase, failing to plan is planning to fail. But the thing is, sometimes planning to fail is crucial and important. For the simple reason, if you find yourself in a position where you are failing and you don't have a plan, what do you do then? How do you get yourself out of a failing state if you haven't thought about it and prepared for it in advance? So what I'm talking about today is just to give a bit of background about the origin of recovery and resolution planning. I'll be talking about what it is, what it is not, and then as introduced, we have the benefit of learning from Owen, our Irish colleague, who's actually worked on this in practice in the Ireland, in Ireland's system. All right, so jumping straight into it, where did all of this come from? All right, now you really can't talk about recovery and resolution planning without talking about the financial crisis in 2008. Massive crash in the market, complete upheaval, disaster, banks, investment houses across the board on the brink of failure. It was in this time that the governments realized that there exists firms that are so deeply ingrained in the financial system that their collapse would be disastrous for the economy. Can't allow this to happen, so the government had to arrange bailouts for these firms, the so-called too big to fail. The term had been coined before that, but it certainly was a time when the term became much more familiar in our dialogue. All right, so the thing is, after this, national debt skyrocketed globally, and there became a sentiment of, all right, well, if you behave irresponsibly, it's fine, the government can bail you out. So, of course, this was a concern because this couldn't continue, and, I mean, this places undue strain on the economy. So they realized that for these big firms, for these ones that are considered too big to fail, they need to start monitoring them a bit more closely. They identified what they call the systemically important financial institutions, the ones that considered if they actually fail or too ingrained in the financial system to allow that. This process was implemented to ensure that there's a relief on taxpayers' costs of having to bail them out, to avoid moral hazard, and generally to ensure a bit more stability in the financial sector. Part of this process was introducing recovery and resolution planning. Now, all right, for fear of losing you at this stage, because, I mean, we're talking here about banks, investment houses, things like that. What does this actually have to do for our insurance industry? So, I mean, it's a fair point. The Financial Stability Board, international body that's responsible for monitoring and making recommendations to the stability of the financial economy globally, they introduced a key paper in 2011 already that introduced recovery and resolution planning requirements for banks. This came to South Africa with a directorate introduced by South African Reserve Bank back in 2015 already. So it's certainly a topic that has been covered quite a lot, but again, in the context of banks. Thing is, though, the FSB started by considering banks, other investment houses, systemically important financial institutions. But then, in conjunction with the IAS, the International Actuarial Supervisory Institution, it's basically the regulator to which all other regulators also have to report to, they started considering insurers that are also SIFI considered entities, and that they should also be considered in terms of can't allow them to fail. And I mean, from that point on, regulations started popping up globally. The IIA certainly introduced the fact that there's such a concept as systemically important insurers. Everybody started to realize the insurers also need to be aware of, or insurers are also important to the financial system. Of course, for South Africa, any and all regulations that start popping up in Europe especially starts getting important for us. So it's a pretty safe bet to say that it's going to come to South Africa. I mean, we even had the amendment bill in 2020 that already allowed for that not just banks and investment houses should be defined as SIFI in South Africa, but that the definition is broadened to encapsulate other companies as well, including insurers. I mean, we're talking about this today. Insurers have been failing. I mean, this certainly is the case. In terms of compared to banks, insurers are catching up in terms of failures and curatorships noticed in the market. Some of you may have attended the presentation of my colleague last year, where he talked about at the convention why insurers fail, and this was already two curatorships ago. So it is something. Insurers have actually already approached us to start doing recovery and resolution planning proactively in preparation for when this comes and to enhance their own enterprise risk management framework. So all of that aside, let's actually jump straight into it. Okay, so just first starting, what is the difference between recovery and resolution? So recovery is when a firm is is experiencing severe financial distress and they need to restore their financial strength or their sustainability. Resolution, on the other hand, is where a firm is unlikely to actually get back to a point of stability and other alternative options have to be considered. So basically what we're saying is for recovery is a firm is in financial distress and they need to make a plan in order to recover, improve financial stability, improve financial strength, and get back to a going concern basis. Where resolution, this typically is when that ship has sailed and you need to start looking at winding down or terminating the firm in its current state. There's then also another point kind of here where I do want to sidetrack a little bit from recovery and resolution planning to say that there's an additional introduction of curatorship. Put it there in the middle because it's a bit of a debate about at what point does this kick in. So with recovery, it's when you are in distress, but you do want to recover, you can recover. Resolution is need to start winding down. I mean, there's some debate about curatorship by the time that it gets introduced. What exactly is the focus then there? So, I mean, to say that there are some opposing views is a bit of an understatement. It's really a question about when should the curator step in. I mean, there are arguments that by the time they've stepped in, it's already too late. It's already gone beyond the point of no return. If they had stepped in earlier, company might have been able to be saved. Of course, the converse argument for that is, by the time the curator steps in, the image in the public starts causing concern, starts causing policyholders to question the sustainability going forward for the insurer, and that can lead to spiral of death. So the question about at what point should the curator step in? Well, as one of my colleagues always says in actuarial matters, it depends. Though it certainly is a concern, or it certainly is something to consider about where they fit in the structure. All right, so that's the difference between recovery and resolution planning. Forgot to mention, recovery planning, that's something that the insurer company itself needs to take care of, put in place. Resolution typically is more on the side of the regulator, where by that time they will step in. Or certainly if it's not the regulator on their own, the regulator would certainly be heavily involved with a firm when it gets to a resolution stage. So from an insurance company point of view, the majority of what you would need to be aware of when talking about resolution would likely be kind of assisting, providing statistics or monitoring. Most of it is in the ballpark of the regulator, though. It's on the recovery planning side where most of it does actually sit with the insurer. All right, so actually getting to, but what is a recovery plan? So I try to summarize it here as best as I can to say that, as I said, live document with a menu of recovery options for specific situations, thoroughly detailed to restore to financial strength. All right, now that sounds simple enough. I mean, it's something that you can think of. Oh, sorry. It sounds simple enough to think of that and think that, all right, now we can put something together. Until you actually start thinking about but what this all entails in a practical situation. So, all right, let's actually think about this in a practical situation for if there is a financial distress for your or your company comes in financial distress. And admittedly, since our last in-person conference in 2019, it's getting a bit more difficult to think of scenarios that affect us as insurers that hasn't happened yet but is still possible. So going aside from the other ones that we have experienced the past 2 years and going down my apocalypse bingo card, let's imagine there's a zombie outbreak happening here in South Africa, for whatever the case may be, but the government decides that it's necessary for, let's call it, extreme resolution or extreme measures in order to contain the situation. Of course, the problem now is South Africa's export completely derails. For the simple reason, well, nobody wants to risk exposure risk or actually receive goods from South Africa. And let's actually throw in there for the hell of it, a reinsurer defaults in this time, given the massive property damage from, well, the initial outbreak and the extreme measures that need to cover that. All right. So, looking at that scenario, first question that you need to ask yourself is, what is our problem? Is it a solvency or a liquidity concern? I think we can say with certainty, if you had been insuring a building, there's going to be some solvency concerns if it did require significant payout. Add to that the fact that your reinsurer defaulted, that's going to further threaten the solvency. I mean, it can also, of course, threaten your liquidity. If you had bargained on a reinsurer being able to give you to affect the cash call clause in order to pay the claims. Something always to bear in mind is liquidity concerns can lead to solvency concerns as well. If in an attempt to actually pay claims, you do need to get rid of assets at a lower than market value price, or of course you move them into a lower yield asset, thus limiting your projected profits. All right, the next problem then is, need to consider, is this specific risk only for your company? Is it industry-wide, or does it actually affect the entire financial industry? For your specific company, of course, it depends on, or it affects the recovery options that you choose. Are you actually going to be able to handle it internally? Are you going to have something external on which you can rely? If it is something that affects the whole industry, as per this case, where an insurer has defaulted and there has been significant increase in claims, there's a serious risk of, but is there actually going to be enough reinsurance to make up for the gap and at what cost? Moving out into if it's the entire financial market, if you want to consider something other than just deferring to a reinsurer in order to restore your solvency or match your liquidity concerns, well, we've just now said our export industry has gone out. So market as a whole, safe to assume, it's gone more expensive in order to actually resolve the matter. Next thing to consider, is this a once-off event or does it have long-term impact? So once-off event, the zombies, hopefully, would only be for that point that you would need to find the capital in order to actually fund the property damage and probably business interruption, whatever the case may be. If it is a longer-term impact, though, as we now know, the market is in a bit of disarray, reinsurer had defaulted, so reinsurance rates probably going to go up as well. The recovery option that you need to consider in this scenario has to cater not just for, at that point, the threat to your capital base. You also need to consider about the long-term plan, long-term implications. Is your pricing going to have to be adjusted? Your reinsurance cost, your cost for other investments, sentiment from policyholders, whatever the case may be, your recovery option needs to take both of these into consideration. On the topic of long-term impact, something else actually important here, something that gets introduced through recovery planning is the concept of your core business and your critical functions. It's actually when you go past recovery to your resolution stage as well, is when you think that what parts of the business are actually core to your sustainability going forward, which parts can you actually part with without it actually threatening your going concern? In this case, depending on how extreme the scenario is, you may actually have to sever ties with certain parts of your business, of your one of your subsidiaries, well, not subsidiaries, part of your business, for the sake of actually being able to continue with your main core functions. Introduces an important point now about insurance groups. So for a group, you would need to have a recovery plan both at a group level as well as for the individual subsidiaries. It's important that the recovery plans can cater at both levels, because the group's recovery options might not be applicable or implementable by their individual subsidiaries. It's also, of course, the concern that you tend to rely on your parent company for a capital injection, but if it's something that affects the whole of the parent company, and in this said zombie outbreak, chances are that capital is going to be scarce. It then also gets a bit awkward if one of the one of the group's recovery options is to actually sever ties with your subsidiary, because it is considered non-critical or not core to the business. So again, when you're thinking about your recovery options, need to account for all of these points. Next thing to consider is your solvency is determined by capital requirements and your basic own funds. So if solvency is threatened, do you reduce your capital requirement or do you increase your basic own funds? I think this leads to the point of there are actually very many options that you can consider as part of your recovery options. I'm not going to go through all of them now. It's just that really want to highlight the fact that for a given scenario, you first need to consider, all right, is it which part of the equation are we addressing? The capital requirements or the own funds side? Is it a liquidity concern? Is it a big enough, long-term enough impact that we actually need to reconsider and restructure the business in its current form? Having identified that, you need to determine the merit of each of your recovery options based on, is it doable? Is it applicable for your specific company? Is it actually available, both in a normal state as well as in a stress state, that it actually will be available at that time? And of course, is it the most cost-efficient solution? Actually, just on the topic of the, is it applicable to your business? When it comes to recovery planning, there isn't one single solution for every single company out there, simply because each company is unique in its own right. I mean, quickly going down the list, the type of business. Is it a life or non-life insurer, composite, micro-insurance? Depending on what your business structure is, will affect what recovery options should you consider are available. Nature of the assets and the liabilities. If you're already invested in the least risky assets, it's not much scope to move around in terms of trying to reduce your capital requirements for your investments. Alternatively, is there scope for asset liability matching in any manner or form? Need to consider the ownership structure. As I mentioned, this is where it's going to be different for different companies, whether there is a parent company to rely on or not. The profitability of the company, when we have to consider actually winding down parts of the business, selling it off, mergers and acquisitions, the profitability of the business will affect how likely it is to actually find a willing buyer to take that part of your business off your hands. The products themselves can affect your recovery options and what is required. Is it simple motor and property insurance? Is it more complicated engineering or guarantee? Is it monthly business, long-term business? The extent of guarantees or benefit options embedded in the product, which admittedly is a bit more applicable to life, all of these things, again, need to be considered when thinking of your recovery option. And I mean, lastly, the credit rating, of course. Your credit rating will directly affect how likely it is for you to actually get external funding if need be. So the point is, there isn't any one single one-size-fits-all solution, since every single insurer is different in its own way. And for that reason, when you are considering and designing your recovery plan, you would need to take this into account. Just quickly getting back to our scenario, just two more points that I want to raise here. The first one is, in this state of disaster, there's going to be a lot of communication necessary to a whole range of different parties. You're going to need to decide how is your escalation process, to discuss it with senior management, to convey the discuss the recovery options, now to put that in place. going to be a bit of a problem if your CEO is one of said zombies busy gnawing on a leg. So it's something that you need to allow for in the communication structure, whose part and fallback plans, if not possible. Your external parties, depending on what your recovery option is, are you going to reinsurers, going to the market, raising debt from your shareholders, need to consider, well, at what point do we start talking to the reinsurers? At what point do we start talking to the reinsurers brokers, the capital markets? Need to consider that one. Need to consider the regulator. Likely they're going to want to know at some point when your solvency is threatened, what are you planning, how are you going to resolve it, where do they need to step in. Going to have to talk to your policyholders. I mean, for the sake of managing your public relations, they'll likely be concerned, threaten the viability of their policies going forward. That would need to be need to have a plan put in place about how that should happen. Mention the shareholder. If you have to start asking for him to write a check, how best and at what point do you communicate that? And, you know, of course, in all this time, these communications can be difficult in the best of times. Now you need to have them in stressed scenarios. Think, for example, if the group needs to tell a subsidiary that they're not actually a core function, might not be the best time to break that news to them during a stress event that group capital is no longer available. They need to make an alternative arrangement. Okay, and then finally, you need to allow for the fact that you need time to choose the recovery option, have it be challenged, have it be accepted, have it be implemented, have it take effect, have it actually help to get to a point where the financial strength is once again restored. A recovery plan is really just a single action. It's typically a range of actions put together and well defined together to ensure that exercising all of them is actually able to, again, restore you back to going concern state. And during all this time, depending on what the delays is, again, in normal, in the best of cases, circumstances, and again, in a stress scenario, how badly is the situation deteriorating while you're trying to implement this? I mean, the problem here is if you're starting from scratch at the point of failure when the problem first arises, and now you have to start frantically thinking of recovery options from first principles, and the situation is deteriorating, not a good place to be in. Also, a good point here to mention, part of recovery planning is identifying triggers in order to assess and monitor while tracking the business and seeing when there is a threat to the business's viability. So different triggers exist. There might be a trigger to first increase monitoring and realize that, okay, there is a problem, need to raise it with the business. There's a trigger when you need to start having the discussions with the external parties, depending on what the option is, getting additional reinsurance, capital injection, whatever the case may be. There's a trigger for when you actually have to implement it. Again, these triggers need to be both qualitative and quantitative, and the necessary resources need to understand exactly how to react depending on the different thresholds. All right, so having gone through all of that, actually talking about what should be part of a recovery plan. Okay, now, it hasn't actually come to South Africa yet. It's, as I mentioned, it is, we have a lot to go on from the FSB's key assignment paper that was published about what they expect in a recovery plan for the banks. We have the European Banking Authority as well. We even have our South African Reserving Bank's directive to draw from in the interim about what is going to be required from a recovery plan. So trying to kind of dilute them into just 4 points of what is required. First one is you need to have credible scenarios, both for your company specifically, but industry-wide as well. What I mean with credible is it needs to be something that actually can happen to your company, is a concern, is something that should be allowed for appropriately. And as I said, insurer-specific and industry-wide, because depending on the risk can affect which recovery option is most suitable. Both solvency and liquidity needs to be concerned. The FSIs have historically focused a lot more on solvency requirements rather than liquidity requirements, which is changing. The PIA is definitely putting a bit more focus on this, and it's actually a global trend. The PIA actually issued some liquidity management Framework Management Guidance Note last year, September. So additional additional monitoring that's likely to come in. Recovery plan should allow for both. All right, the next one is process for timely and practical implementation. Process, because a recovery plan is not just one thing. You need to allow for how these things step through one another. The timely, as I mentioned, it's have to allow for the fact that it's going to take time to go through them, have to consider what is the risk or the implication if there is a delay at any stage of the process. Of course, the practical implementation, as I said, it needs to be something that will actually be available, will actually be sensible, will be doable for your specific insurance company. Last one is to align the triggers and your indicators to the recovery options. So as I said, yeah, it needs to be, you need to make sure that you have the appropriate triggers in place for the different stages of the recovery plan, of when you need to allow for external communication, raising, escalating, and implementing. Does require then also that there is a thorough governance process around recovery planning. And what I mean with that is you need to make sure that everybody that should be involved in setting up the recovery plan initially are involved. Need to make sure that they are capable of assisting with it. Need to make sure that they are that everybody is involved from the start, simply because problems with implementation might only be known by certain individuals, and if they are not part of the initial recovery plan, it would definitely help the thoroughness of the plan if all of those parties are working on it together. All right. Now you might ask, before I get there, as I said, for the sake of this presentation, I did try to keep the requirements at a high level. Thing is, it's actually a bit more detailed if you really start looking at it. The Irish regulations, they're quite far advanced in terms of having this implemented. It's why I asked my colleague Owen to present from his practical experience as well. The regulator, the Central Bank of Ireland, published guidelines in terms of what's actually required from a recovery plan. Again, not going to go through all of them now, but just to highlight again, this is the level of detail that the regulator is likely going to expect from the recovery plan. And it's something that you would need to, have to ensure that when you do devise the recovery plan, that it is hitting all of these points. All right. You might be asking now at this stage, how is a recovery plan not just an ORSA pretending to be something that it isn't? Yeah, it's a fair question, because there definitely is a lot of overlap, and it is a very useful place to start from. Differences come in, though. The ORSA and the recovery plan will have different focus. The ORSA is typically used to test whether your financial projections and your business plan will be able to sustain different experience, different scenarios, different best estimates. So typically it would not really result in financial insolvency, not in lack of sustainability, with the exception of the reverse stress test. It's typically mostly to show that, look, irrespective of what happens, we will be able to still stand tall. The recovery plan, on the other hand, your starting point is, well, all right, we are now in financial difficulty. What are we now going to do to get out of it? Next difference is the fact that your ORSA typically only has really high-level commentary about what do you do if solvency is breached, your triggers are tripped, whatever the case may be. We typically have very high-level management responses, management intervention, very likely or typically not included or very light considerations of the implementation for them of how to respond to it. Typically also more focused on the solvency rather than the liquidity. Your recovery plan is not just to say, well, is it possible? It's to say that, okay, well, it has happened. What do we do now? Really thought out, really detailed. Just the other point to make there, the fact that for your ORSA typical business processes for risk appetite, your triggers really will be that, all right, well, at this trigger, this is where we have concerns we raise escalated, start making a plan for considering how to restore solvency. For the recovery plan, the additional triggers about monitoring earlier, starting to engage with external parties, all of these additional triggers also needs to be introduced. All right, then another question that can be asked is, okay, but how is it not just a BCM? So business continuity management, it's a bit less known for this crowd compared to a ORSA, unless you are very closely linked to the risk department as well. Your business continuity management and disaster recovery planning is typically a lot of what I am describing now, a plan that is put together to in a situation where there is a disaster, a scenario, something that occurred that limits your ability to perform your business functions, and how are you going to resolve that. Also introduces then the principle of your core business and your critical business functions. Very useful source thing to draw from that. Thing is though, BCM is typically focused more on operational risk rather than financial risk. So your BCM would typically be considering things like there's a collapse in your IT, there's a collapse, your access to the building has been restricted, loss of key individual persons. So again, where all of these are more operationally linked and your recovery options would typically be redundant backup, supply chain management, ensuring that there are individuals that can replace key individuals. Very rarely do they actually consider that, well, if there's a financial concern, what is the backup on that one? It's also another point to make on that. Your BCM plan typically is not as extreme to say that the company is now in financial distress. It would more typically be a case of, well, we have this problem, how do we resolve it? Where the recovery plan again is, okay, well, things have really now gone bad, how are we going to recover from this? All right. Then just taking a step back from everything that I've mentioned now. I mean, insurers are failing. We have seen this. Insurers are failing. They put under curatorship. I mean, this is happening despite the prudential authorities' requirements for all of the reporting, all of the monitoring, despite all of the have sign-off and intervention. Well, not intervention. Have sign-off and monitoring as well. So clearly there is a need to apply a bit more focus on how to actually ensure for sustainability of insurers for the market as a whole. Question for the insurers that fell or collapsed can ask, well, if they had a recovery plan, could it have been avoided? Would it have helped to have better decisions or readily available decisions that could be enacted on rather than only reacting to it at that time? Point there actually to make, I mean, I've just highlighted the recovery plan, quite an extensive document that you would need to put together. Part of the process can entail creating a user manual or a playbook, something that you can refer to in a time of the stress or financial disaster. The playbook can be referred to in terms of, well, what is the plan? What are we, depending on the situation, what is the plan? What is the merit escalation process? Enactment process. Other concern or other consideration just in terms of this is if you have a recovery plan, chances are you're going to give a lot more confidence or your comfort to the PA, to your regulator, to show that, no, okay, well, we know that we're in trouble now, but look, we have a plan and we know exactly how we're going to get out of the problem that we currently are in. May help assist the time at which curatorship has to happen, may assist actually the need for curatorship to step in. It really does again boil down to the fact that, well, it's a lot easier to be able to respond to a situation if you don't only have to start thinking about the problem when it has already happened. All right, so it's all good and well to talk about this from a theoretical point of view. I mean, as I said, regulations haven't come to South Africa yet, so we don't have a clear-cut guideline in terms of what is going to be required or when it's going to be required. We have external sources that we can draw on to inform a theoretical view. Much more beneficial, though, is to actually learn from practical experience This is where I would like to introduce my colleague Owen, who, as I've said, in Ireland's regulatory environment, has already been exposed to quite a lot of the considerations and the designing of a recovery plan. So with that, Owen.
Hi, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes, can hear you.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. So, as Chris mentioned, I'm going to talk about some of the lessons we've learned where we've been working with companies in the Irish market to develop preemptive recovery plans. I'm also going to draw on some of the experiences of some of my Milliman colleagues in South Africa who have started working with a number of insurers in developing plans. So we'll start with the first lesson. If you could advance the slides there, please, Chris.
I just want to check. There are the rest of the presentation. Can we just bring that back up?
Excellent. So if we can move on to the next slide now. The first lesson in relation to the preparation of recovery plans really is that it's not a trivial exercise. So we've seen that it can take quite a lot of time to develop a plan. In Ireland, the regulations requiring insurers to develop plans were introduced in April 2021, and companies had until March 2022 to actually have their plans in place. And most companies were scrambling around at the last minute to get their plans approved by the board. So it took the best part of 11 months for most companies to put those plans in place. And that's even when they knew that the regulations were already coming before April 2021 because there had been consultations. So given how long it takes to put in place, I think companies are better off starting to put things in place long before there's actually any requirement to do so. You're better off having a plan and not needing it than needing a plan and not having it. So with that in mind, how do you go about preparing a plan from scratch for the first time? I think the first thing is that a template or a skeleton can help you focus attention on what needs to be included in the plan. And Chris showed on the slide earlier on the various chapters that are included in the Irish guidelines, so they can be a useful kind of starting point to understand the different things that you need to include. Once you have a skeleton in place, you can then look at performing a gap analysis and seeing what information might already be available to you from other sources. For example, we've seen in Ireland a lot of companies, the indicators they use to trigger their plan are aligned with key risk indicators that they were already monitoring. Some of the scenarios that companies were analysing were also aligned to scenarios in their ORSA process. So you can already have a wealth of information available, so you're not necessarily starting from scratch. But performing that gap analysis is a good way to understand what is available and what you do need to prepare. You also need to consider, once you've actually drafted your plan, how are you going to implement it into your risk management system? You need to monitor indicators. You need to do scenario analysis. You need to know when to implement the plan. So you need to consider how to implement that plan and engage with other elements of the business and integrate it into your risk management system. The second lesson that we have learned then is you needed a coordinated approach across the business if you're going to recover. This isn't just an actuarial or risk exercise. You need to have buy-in from all the stakeholders that are going to be involved and make sure that everybody understands their roles and responsibilities. So to give a very simple example, supposing one of your recovery options is to reduce your expenses. And you decide that in order to reduce your expenses, you need to have some staff layoffs. Involving your legal team and your HR department in preparing your plan and implementing the plan will be key in that area. You'll need to understand, what's the legal process for letting people off? How long would it take? Is there any redundancy payments that we'd have to make, and what would they cost? You need to understand those things. So you need to involve the experts, the legal and the HR experts, in those decisions, rather than relying solely on assumptions that you might make as an actuary or somebody in the risk space who's not as close to the detail. And there are numerous other examples I could give in that space as well. So you need to involve a lot of stakeholders and get buy-in from all those stakeholders across the business. Moving on then to our third lesson on the next slide. Strategic analysis is hard. And when I talk about strategic analysis here, I'm referring to a specific concept in the Irish regulations, but it could be called different things in other regulations. But the idea is, it goes back to something that Chris mentioned earlier on, where you're looking at what are our core business lines, our key products, our key geographies, what are the critical functions in the company, what are our exposures to internal and external counterparties. This is the section that you really have to understand your business and help a third party or a regulator understand your business also. And it can be difficult to do that. So, for example, what are your core business lines? In the Irish regulations, we were told that we needed to identify them, but we weren't told what the definition was. So do you look at things like your market share? Do you look at premium volumes? Do you look at the level of technical provisions? Do you look at the level of capital that certain business lines attract? And even if you think you're clear on what your core business lines are, is the regulator in agreement with you on what your core business lines are? For example, you might write a small product in the greater scheme of things for your balance sheet, but it might be in a niche area that many other insurers don't operate in. And if you were to withdraw that product from the market, maybe there would be a gap in the market that the regulator would not like to see. And therefore, that service that you don't see as core might be perceived as core by the regulator or somebody else. Another question might be, what are our critical functions? So to give an example of this, you know, generally we think of critical functions as the absolute bare minimum functions we need to keep a company going. We need to be able to pay claims to policyholders. We need to be able to process various policyholder requests. So we need some form of operations, client services teams that would be able to do that. But what other functions do you need? In Europe, under Solvency II, there are four key functions defined by Solvency II: the internal audit function, the risk function, compliance, and actuarial. But are they critical in the concept of a recovery plan where you're trying to cut costs and just keep the company afloat? Some people would say yes, some people would say no. Again, it's just one of those areas that's a little bit ambiguous. So you need to decide yourself what your critical functions are. Lesson four, then, is that the choice of indicators is important. As Chris has alluded to, you need to detect a problem in a timely fashion. You need to be able to implement the options when they can actually have some effect and help restore financial viability for a company. But you don't want to trigger the plan too soon. When you go and develop the plan, you'll see that there's a lot of governance and communications that need to be put in place around the implementation of a plan. You might need to notify certain stakeholders, including the regulator. So you don't want to actually pull the trigger and implement the plan too soon. We conducted a survey of our clients in the Irish market, and we asked them about some of their choices of indicators. Most companies had a capital indicator and a liquidity indicator as required by the Irish regulations. Some had some other indicators as well. About half had a profitability indicator and another half had an operational indicator. But beyond that, people didn't have many other indicators. So they're keeping the number of indicators that they're monitoring to a bare minimum, just monitoring the ones that they see as most important. The other thing in relation to indicators is, as I mentioned earlier on, very few companies created new indicators. They were relying on the existing KRI. So again, trying to use information you already have available rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and start from scratch. Moving on then to lesson five, you need to have a full menu of possible recovery options. In our experience working with Irish companies, they generally started with as many as 12 or 13 options. They generally then held workshops with key stakeholders to discuss each option in terms of its viability, its potential effectiveness. And they tried to whittle the list down to a more manageable list that would be included in their plan. So generally, companies started with maybe 12 or 13 options and ended up with five or six key options that they felt were the most relevant for their business. I guess the other thing that you need to bear in mind is that not all options will be credible or effective in all scenarios. So, for example, some options that are very good at restoring your solvency position might not be good at restoring your liquidity position. So Chris talked about the numerator and the denominator earlier on. If you reduce your capital requirements, that can help your solvency position, but it mightn't mean anything for your liquidity position. So you need to have indicators that will help with both. You might also need to consider the fact that if one of your options is something like relying on your parent for group, what would happen if that support wasn't available? So you need to have more than one option to help restore your financial well-being just in case one isn't available or effective. When we surveyed our clients, what we found was that on average, companies had about five or six options to improve solvency and about three or four to improve liquidity. The most popular options were things like parental capital support, closure to new business, expense reduction, and suspending dividends. Other options that were less popular were things in relation to getting capital outside of the group or from outside the parent, redesigning products to make products more capital effective or more profitable, looking at various forms of reinsurance, selling a portfolio of liabilities or hedging or ALM to reduce the risk profile. I suppose one other thing I would just note in relation to these options as well is that in some cases, these options, you don't need to rely on the recovery plan being triggered to implement these options. You know, Chris talked earlier on about kind of early warnings and kind of, you know, various escalation steps along the way. So you might have a target level of solvency coverage. And if you dip below that, even if your recovery plan isn't implemented, you might decide to use some of these options to get back to your target level. However, they can still be viable and useful recovery options because sometimes scenarios are very fast moving and you don't have time to do any intermediate steps. You go straight from being in the green and perfectly viable to in financial difficulty in a very short space of time. So even some of those options that you might think you would implement early on in the process can be viable recovery options. Moving on then to lesson 7 on the next slide, this calibration of your scenarios can be quite important. So in the Irish regulations, companies need to consider a company-specific scenario, a macroeconomic scenario, and a combined scenario. And each of those scenarios needs to be extreme enough to trigger your indicators and show that your indicators are calibrated to identify when you are in difficulty. But they still need to be plausible enough that you can say, yes, this is a viable threat to my business. So there's clearly a link with your ORSA and maybe your BCP and your BCM that Chris mentioned earlier on in this space. Another question is operation resilience, so that BCM piece that Chris mentioned earlier on, is that something you're going to factor into this plan, or will you have another recovery plan or business continuity plan elsewhere that will deal with those more operational events? In Ireland, recovering the ability and the demand required for more operational type events. When we surveyed our clients, the thing that we discovered was not all companies were able to find scenarios that led to solvency or liquidity breaches. And you have to ask yourself the question for those companies then, are these companies really bulletproof? Is there no scenario that can lead to financial difficulty? Or do they potentially have a blind spot that they haven't identified yet that could lead them into a false sense of security? So you really need to work hard to find the right scenarios for your business that will lead to difficulty, trigger your indicators, make sure your indicators are calibrated appropriately, and then use those scenarios to examine your options and see if those options are effective in restoring your financial well-being in those scenarios as well. So this is going to be a key area for most plans. Moving on then to the next slide and lesson 8, which is that your plan isn't going to be perfect first time around. We expect that companies are going to have multiple iterations before they get their plan to the stage where they're fully happy with it. So you should be asking yourselves, what steps can we take now to make the plan easier to implement in future if we ever need to do that? And I suppose just the picture here, I'm not sure how clear it is for people, but I'm just drawing the analogy between recovery plans and maybe cooking a meal. So you might just decide we're going to cook a particular dish and leave it at that. That's maybe your first version of the plan. But you might also decide, okay, I'm going to cook this dish. I'm going to look up a recipe in a book. I'm going to see what ingredients are needed. I'm going to go to the supermarket. I'm going to buy those ingredients. When I get home, I'm going to weigh everything out. I'm going to chop everything. So when I come to make the dish, I've done all the hard work and the actual cooking of the dish is the easy part. It can be the same with recovery plans. So for example, if one of your options is to close a particular line of business or sell a particular line of business, how would you go about doing that? What are the legal impediments in place? Are there draft documents you could prepare now that if you were to sell the business, you would have in place? Do you know if you would engage an investment bank to sell that portfolio of business? What investment bank would you engage? Would you have a target company in mind as an acquirer? Who would that company be? So there's lots of the steps you can do to make your plan easier to implement if you ever do get into financial distress. And finally, for me, having done all that work and having done the hard thinking and developed the plan, it's great to know that it's there. And if you ever get into financial difficulty, that you can draw on it, but you don't really want to go there in the first place. So take comfort from having the plan. That shouldn't lure you into a false sense of security, that you can take risks. You really don't want to implement these plans. You want to leave them on the shelf and take comfort from the fact that they're there, but not actually ever need to use them. So that's everything I was going to go through. So I'll hand you back to Chris for any Q&A.
Perfect. Owen, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone. My sincere apologies. I see we are horribly out of time. Just a closing comment as I finish off. Question is, of course, what can you do now in preparation before the regulations inevitably are introduced? You can start by looking at your ORSA to see how can you expand it to start catering for the considerations required by a recovery plan. Similarly, looking at the maturity of your business continuity management process, disaster recovery plans, starting to identify who should be involved in starting to construct the recovery options, who should be involved in their discussions, how can you actually start going about preparing yourself? Thank you again for everyone. Owen, thank you again for dialing in. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Do we have any questions in the room? We do have one or two online, so maybe we can just ask you a quick question.
Sure.
In your research for the talk, would it appear that the licenses placed under curatorship had sufficient actuarial intervention before, i.e. adequate authors and or scenario testing to equip management to take active steps to avoid insolvency?
So I can say that part of the preparation didn't actually look at those in detail, simply because it's very easy to nitpick and look in hindsight after the fact, oh, this was your problem, this should have been done better, this is what actually should have been, you know, handled differently. Much more challenging is going forward to think, okay, but for us, the problem isn't there yet. What can we actually do to resolve it?
Maybe another quick one. Just when in your mind should the regulator step in with the curatorship?
I'm not brave enough to answer that.
Hi, my question is just, so you've mentioned that there's a requirement to come up with the plan, but in the event that the plan is needed, is it a requirement that that plan is followed and not deviated from? Because sometimes the worry is that in the event, are they really going to pull out the plan and follow it? So I'm just curious what the regulations in Ireland or that are coming have looked into that as well.
I mean, I can answer that quickly, although Owen, please jump in if you also have something to add. But in my view, if that's the case, that's a sign of a failed recovery plan. I mean, if there's, you need to allow for the fact that there's the ideal recovery, there's the plan B, and there's the, well, none of this is applicable, we need to allow for plan Z. And the whole purpose of the recovery plan is that you don't at that time only have to start worrying, oh no, we have to throw everything out and start from scratch. The challenge is to actually think in advance, how can you allow for all of the situations? Easier said than done, but that really is the purpose of not having to react when it's already too late.
Last question. Do you know how many insurers currently have a robust recovery plan in place?
I mean, I'm aware of a few that we have been interacting with that have proactively started with it, but haven't really seen any statistics of that in the market, so can't say with certainty.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Thank you, Owen.
Thank you.